Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. It's great to have you here. This is another edition of Red Ice. My name is Henrik. So today we have invited back to the show Professor Kevin McDonald. I wanted to actually talk a bit about the JQ and go back to the some of the 101 kind of points that I think is very important to kind of zoom out a little bit and discuss why people in the alt-right discuss this question, why it is important, why it is relevant. And I think none other than Kevin McDonald, of course, is the preeminent scholar, if you will, on this work. So thank you for coming on, Kevin. It's good to have you here again.
It's great to be here again, Henry. Always great to be here.
Excellent. So let's kind of, as I said, zoom out a bit here. I mean, there's so many components to this question. You've written countless of volumes on this, of course, publications, articles. You are, of course, behind, for those who are new to your work, three volumes on the issue. The first two ones was A People That Shall Dwell Alone, and then it's Separation and Discontent, and then finally The Culture of Critique. And these go back to, you know, 94, 98, and then, of course, The Culture of Critique was the latest one. But if you had the chance, Kevin, to address to a group of people who are genuinely interested in history but knows nothing of the validity of the question of Jewish interests and the different groups that are pushing for their interests and so forth, what would you say to them? How would you explain the issue to them of why the kind of work that you've been doing is important?
I think that's the key. What you said was that different groups have different interests. So that was the whole premise here. Sometimes it's sort of liberal fantasy land that we're all the same and we're all going to get along and we all have the same interests. Well, as an evolutionary psychologist, I simply didn't believe that. I mean, conflict of interest is fundamental. And I was, you know, as I say, an evolutionary psychologist, and I was looking for a project involving groups because the standard idea was that groups didn't matter. So I latched on to Judaism simply as, you know, as something where there's an awful lot written about them. And as I read, I started to really realize, especially as I got into the 20th century, if you go back in history, you can say, well, those are things that are over and done with, water over the dam. But it was, as I was reading about the 20th century, I could see that these Jewish intellectual movements and Jewish political activism on immigration and civil rights and all these other things were not in the interests of the white majority. And so I developed a conflict theory of culture that important, there are other aspects of culture, of course, but conflict is fundamental. And Jews, the whole point of the book Culture of Critique was to look at some of these Jewish intellectual movements and to show that they were dominated by Jews who strongly identified as Jews. They had very strong Jewish identities. And they thought of what they were doing as furthering Jewish interests. One obvious one was ending anti-Semitism. But they also saw, when they came to America, for example, they correctly saw that there was a sort of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant power structure, and that they were not part of that, really. And I think a major part of that was to topple that power structure, to assume a dominant role, you know, to be able to dominate prestigious institutions and other aspects of the culture, the media, in a way that had been dominated by these white Anglo-Saxons before them. Part of that was simply to increase their power by lowering the power of the previous establishment. And they have succeeded dramatically. So now you have this new Jewish elite. It's not completely a Jewish elite, but anybody in the elite has basically made alliances with Jews, or you might say that Jews have a sort of veto power over other parts of the elite. That is, if someone gets out of line, if they make statements about Jews or other aspects of multiculturalism, about Israel and so on, they can be dealt with. And there's a long history of people who have been pretty prestigious in the media. Just recently, Kevin Myers over in the UK said some things about Jews that they didn't like. He was implying that they were, you know, good at negotiating salaries and they tended not to take lower salaries. And, you know, they were good negotiators and all that. And even that was deemed anti-Semitic. He lost his job. He's pilloried and they want his scalp now. So that's what they do. Any member who's is part of the establishment that gets off the reservation, they have the power to ruin their livelihood, to essentially ruin their lives. And so what we have now is this new Jewish elite that is very powerful and whose power can't be even discussed in a rational way. You can bring up all the facts you want. You can do anything you want in terms of empirical research, but it won't break through because any discussion of Jewish power is off limits. And anyone who does it is going to be in danger of losing their livelihood. They certainly tried to get me fired for a long time. And they're substantially successful at this. So this is our new elite. Back in the 1950s, when there was still a sort of WASP elite in America, you could discuss the WASP elite. There were books and articles often written by Jews, very critical of this elite. They would complain about how they were standoffish, that they wouldn't allow other peoples into their country clubs and so on. There were certain law firms in New York that wouldn't hire Jews, or faculty at prestigious universities that didn't hire Jews. And so there was always this drumbeat of how corrupt this establishment was. But now any criticism of the establishment, and even noting that it's a very strong Jewish element in it, is off limits, and you will endanger losing your job.
Yeah, that's right. Look at some of the reactions with Trump, for example. He has managed to kind of pull out this paranoia, I think, within this elite that you're talking about, where every little sign and symbol somehow relates back to them, or that they see themselves in this, that he's pointing us out. This is really anti-Semitic. And of course, you also have within the group, Kevin, organizations that are solely dedicated to looking at people who are talking about this aspect that they hold power within certain fields, such as you say, banking and certainly academia, but also entertainment and things like that. You have ADL and even to a certain extent SPLC, and they release regular reports and updates on who's noticed what within the Jewish interest groups and things like this. So you're right when you said that even merely pointing this out has now become an issue. I mean, a standing joke to a certain extent. Is this old edict that said, well, you know, an anti-Semite used to be someone who didn't like Jews, and today, of course, it's something that Jews don't like, right? That's what an anti-Semite is.
That is so true. That is so true, and it's really become a major problem, you know, for anyone like myself who talks about these things, and of course, then anybody on the alt-right who does it. But the fact is that all the prestigious institutions in our society are intensively policed for any deviation from these things. So if you have a job in the academic world, you will certainly not get a job unless you show your stripes. And that would often mean, having the right ideas on multiculturalism, the right ideas on minorities, the right ideas on white guilt for the past and all those things. And any deviation from that, well, even if you have tenure, you're going to be ostracized within the university. You're not going to get any grants. You're not going to have any friends. And so it's a tough life. I've gotten quite a few emails over the years from people who are thinking about going into an academic career. And I always tell them, you know, you're going to have to be a secret agent. It's not going to be a fun life. You're not going to have a lot of friends. You're not going to be invited to parties if you come out. And you have to be a secret agent at least until after you get tenure. But even then, in many universities, your pay is determined by committees. You're just simply not going to have a good life, even if you come out. You can publish, do this kind of thing, but you're going to pay a cost. There are very few people who do this, and some of them who are have been retired. And they don't really have to worry about the cost of it anymore. And that's what's wise, sadly.
Well, there's people like yourself, of course, that have done this kind of work and taken those initial hits. And now I think more and more people are... we'll get into this a little bit later in terms of how maybe this climate is beginning to change a little bit. But let me just go back to your own career for a moment, because you said you were talking about, or you were interested in Jews as a group, as a people, because there was a lot of things written about that you didn't at all start out on this page, obviously, right? Did you pick the group because it was a lot of material available about them? Was that correct?
You know, I have to say, when I was in the university back in the 60s, I was something of a philo-Semite. I really hung out with a lot of Jewish roommates. And, you know, I was on the left at the University of Wisconsin in the 1960s. It was very Jewish. A lot of them were from New York. And so I got used to a sort of Jewish milieu. And there were prominent Jewish professors at the university. And then I got into that. But then as I got away from university, I got away from that. But I didn't really, you know, I voted for Reagan in 1984. But I really could not, by any stretch of imagination, I was nowhere near where I am now. And it really was a matter of reading the history of Jewish history, the history of anti-Semitism, and so on. These are the things that really woke me up. I mean, as an evolutionary psychologist, you simply don't go in with something like this with the understanding that group conflict is always going to be the result of, in this case, the Christian Europeans. Yet that's the way it's all depicted. And so in my book, The Separation of Discontents, that was very eye-opening for me, because I read about all these anti-Jewish actions going back to the Roman times, Middle Ages, and so on. And it was clear to me that Jews were a big part of those equations. And oftentimes there's resource competition involved. Jews oftentimes did engage in exploitative practices with respect to non-Jews, which is, you know, part of Jewish law. I mean, Jewish law, it does not have a sort of universalistic ethics. I mean, they have very different ethics for how you treat non-Jews versus Jews. And one of the things you can do with non-Jews is exploit them economically. You don't have any compunction about charging as high interest rates as you can, about lending money to people that you know are not going to be able to pay it back very well without, you know, selling all their possessions and everything else. And so this was a pattern throughout history. And then in the modern world, of course, it became different because Jews started to enter the mainstream of the West. The Western culture opened up, you know, the Enlightenment. And Jews started to get into the mainstream. Jews started owning media, contributing to media, becoming intellectuals. And that really took off in the 20th century. And that's really the basis of that I cover in the Culture of Critique. For centuries, Jews were sort of relegated to their own ghettos. They didn't even associate with non-Jews. So they were out of the Western intellectual tradition. They didn't contribute to the science or the philosophy or anything. I mean, the only exception was Spinoza, who was sort of he was expelled from the Jewish community. He was a renegade. And because Jewish communities were completely insular and they did not allow any kind of contact with non-Jews.
Was that because they wanted to be, or was that because they were in a situation where they were being actively held out? Maybe a little bit of both, I guess.
Both. One of the famous quote I got from Paul Johnson in his History of the Jews was that if the rabbis had their way, the walls would have been higher. In other words, the official policy in the Jewish community was to make those walls. Jews have always tried to live in their own neighborhoods. And you still see that with Orthodox Jewish communities today. There are certain neighborhoods in New York City and upstate New York where they're completely Jewish. And they want to be in an area where they can walk to the synagogue on Saturday and all those kinds of things. And so Jews have always lived in proximity to each other. That's a very important aspect of diaspora Judaism. So they kept separate. And if you look at the Old Testament, it was one of the first things I read was the Old Testament. I've never done it. The theme of remaining separate is a fundamental drumbeat throughout that. And there are all kinds of punishments from God if you transgress that and start, interacting with non-Jews. And so it was a real eye-opener to see this sort of thing and to sort of understand the history of it. And then, again, when I started reading about Jewish involvement in immigration policy, that was the one that really put me over the top. I mean, it was something like psychoanalysis. You can undo that, you know. I mean, psychoanalysis is now not very popular. I mean, you don't see any psychology PhD programs of any kind of reputation that'll have anything to do with psychoanalysis. It's not science, and it's never been science. And even in departments of psychiatry, it has no sway. You can undo that. But when you're importing 60 million people, you can't undo that very well. That's setting up a massive ethnic conflict. And that is radically opposed to the interests of the white majority. And you know, the whole point of Chapter 7 of Culture of Critique, this was a Jewish project. They had lost the battle in 1924. Jews were not as influential, as dominant as they became after World War II. They lost that. 40 years later, they got the law, the immigration law in 1965. That dramatically changed the country. It took a while because at first it was designed not to really change the ethnic balance. But once you got the principle in that you couldn't bias immigration towards Western Europe, as it always had been, that principle was gone. And so that allowed immigration from all peoples of the world. And now you have whites gradually declining in America, 60-65%, less than that now. And it's going to continue. All demographic projections are that we're going to be a minority unless we do something. And this is a disaster. This is an absolute cataclysmic disaster for the white majority. And it's a result of Jewish activism. And so that's a fundamental thing with me, that when I started reading about that, that's when I got angry, you might say. I started really getting involved. And I said, I've got to be an activist. I got to be more than this academic spinning these things in my computer. I mean, I got to really get out there because, you know, this is just an absolute travesty. And it's not something that the white majority ever wanted. They never voted for it, and they don't deserve it. So that's when I started really getting involved.
So how did you kind of notice that, or how was that? Because if you weren't on that page initially, Kevin, obviously a transformation occurred as you were reading and learning. Did it become evidently clear to you that, oh, this is, they're intending this? I mean, was that, because in many cases, it's very out in the open. It's just not discussed very much. It's kind of hidden, you know, in the back pages of things and academic works and stuff like that. But it's there, right? It's in the open. So you saw that this was an active measure to somehow protect them, or how was there a definition of why this needed to be done?
Well, I think there were different motives. One was this is especially after World War II, and the Frankfurt School is really pivotal, I think, in understanding how Jews changed, because prior to World War II, the sort of mainstream Jewish community was on the left. A lot of them were on the radical left. A lot of them were involved in the Communist Party. They were the backbone of the radical left in America and the Western Europe and everywhere. But I think what the Frankfurt School saw was that in Germany, the working class had voted for Hitler. This was not supposed to happen, you know, and they developed the idea that it really wasn't class struggle so much as it was a racial ethnic struggle. And so the whole thrust of their work was to pathologize any sense of white identification, any sense of white ethnocentrism. That's what had to be eradicated. And so you had the idea that white ethnocentrism was really a sort of medical problem, not sort of a medical problem, it was a medical problem. They would talk about virulent anti-Semitism. It's a virus, it's a medical problem. It has to be contained as a public health problem. And that's the kind of thinking that they started to go into when they realized that classical Marxism was not simply not adequate. Class struggle was not what was happening. It was really an ethnic struggle, and they in a way it always was an ethnic struggle with Jews, because even if you look at these radical Jews in the 1930s, they had strong Jewish identification, and a lot of them. Had the view that what they were doing advanced Jewish interests. They had the view that you had this WASP power structure that was evil. We had to tear that down. And implicit in that, and certainly on the basis of their experience in the Soviet Union, implicit in that was the idea that Jews would then become a dominant elite. The first huge event of the 20th century, of course, was the Bolshevik Revolution. And Jews became a dominant elite in the Soviet Union. This had dramatic effects on all the rest of the history of the 20th century. But one of the big effects was among Jews, it was thought of as good for the Jews. I mean, you could talk about the murders and the 20 million murdered and the gulags and the whole thing. But the bottom line was that from the standpoint of Jewish interests, it was just wonderful because now they were out of the ghetto, out of the shtetls. They had moved into the mainstream. They dominated the media. They dominated the secret police. They were in the science academies, the academies of literature, academics, and so on. And they were doing very, very well. The book by Yuri Slutsky called The Jewish Century is really a classic statement of Jewish power in the Soviet Union. But this had huge effects on the American left because Jews in America said, hey, this is good for the Jews. This is what we want in America. And so they wanted this communist revolution. But I think after World War II, it changed because, first of all, Jews started getting persecuted in the Soviet Union. You know, that they started to get pushed out of their dominant position, and Jews started to be, you know, the ones who were the main dissidents in the Soviet Union. They were the ones who wanted to emigrate out of the Soviet Union, go to Israel and all that. And so it changed, but especially because, as I said, they realized that the working class in Germany had voted for Hitler. And they really started to see it. This is not a class struggle. This is a struggle of race and ethnicity. And anyway, I couldn't agree more. So their solution was to sort of pathologize white ethnocentrism, which they, you know, it was always in the back of their mind is how these white Americans could become Nazis. You know, they have another National Socialist Revolution. And these same white people who voted for Hitler, well, they're going to, in America, they'll vote for someone like Hitler. And you know, during the campaign, that was a constant refrain in Jewish media about Trump. This is a new Hitler. It was constant from neocons and Jews on the left. I wrote four or five articles for VDare on that phenomenon. And comparing Trump to Hitler was just absolutely standard practice. And so and that's the fear. That the whites can rise up and form this National Socialist Party. So what's their solution? Bring in hordes of non-whites.
But Kevin, isn't that going to create those other conditions? I mean, for those who look at history and look at, you know, Austria, maybe to a certain extent the Austro-Hungarian Empire as well, there was a kind of the multiculturalism they had then was very mellow compared to what we have today, but it was still enough there to kind of initiate and trigger these things. I think, I forget who talked about it, but someone did studies obviously of the more kind of multicultural societies they have, the more prone there was to kind of have an authoritarian government eventually rise out of that. So to a certain extent, yes, there might be a survival strategy in trying to kind of make sure that we cannot organized ethnically or the more diverse societies, the less prone we are to that. But at the same time, that could also trigger an effect, right? It could basically bring this out.
It can, you know, this strategy is not foolproof for them from their point of view. They're bringing a lot of people who don't care about the Holocaust, who don't care really about Jewish interests. They're bringing a lot of Muslims who hate Jews and hate Israel. And some Jews, I do think, are rethinking this because, for example, in the UK, with the Labour Party, it's become dependent on Muslim votes. It's become quite anti-Israel. Jeremy Corbyn has been pilloried as an anti-Semite in the press. They've lost pretty much all their Jewish support. Very few Jews now vote for Labour. Overwhelmingly, they vote conservative because Labour Party has become the party of anti-Israel. And they are concerned that these immigrants don't care about Israel, and a lot of them are hostile towards Israel and hostile towards Jews. I mean, you have a certain amount of emigration from France and the UK to Israel simply because of street crime and that sort of thing against Jews. So this is not a foolproof recipe for them. But I have yet to see any major Jewish organization oppose immigration, multiculturalism, very generous refugee policies, and all of that. That it still has not filtered up to the power structures in the Jewish community. You don't see any of that. So I'm not optimistic it's going to change anytime soon. I mean, there are always a few Jews who have it right. We have a couple that write for Occidental Observer, and they get it. They understand that Jews are a huge part responsible for what happened to whites in America. And they understand that as Jews, they, you know, they don't think it's a good idea for Jews to be doing this. And they have some good reasons for that. But that, again, they're just a very tiny minority. That's not where the money is. That's not where the Jewish power is in the organized Jewish community. So at this point, we still have to deal with the organized Jewish community. And it's very powerful, very well funded. You look at the Israel lobbies, case in point. You know, it's astonishing that what they're trying to do now with this anti-boycott, divestment, and sanctions bill in Congress. This is a bill that would prohibit even discussing boycotts, getting information about boycotts. It's an extreme violation of the First Amendment. But these pro-Israel groups are pushing it, and it's got huge support in Congress. It's just mind-boggling that to think that this group can get that much support for things that are just so obviously un-American, obviously opposed to the Constitution, and obviously against the interests of America.
Yeah, it's true. There's a lot of components within what's happening right now that I want to return to a little bit later. For a moment, if we talk a little bit about some of the organizations that are behind them pushing immigration, let's think of the newcomer. Let's think about the kind of person who's very unfamiliar with these issues. And listening to you, they might just go, "What are you talking about?" Like there's a number of organizations out there, yada yada. But if we for a moment take a look at some of them, Kevin, we have of course groups such as HIAS, which stands for what is it, Hebrew?
Immigrant Aid Society.
Exactly, Immigrant Aid Society, which have been pushing this for a long, long time. I think they go back to, I don't know if it's the 20s or 30s or something like that.
Yeah, at first it was all about Jewish immigrants, but not anymore.
No, exactly. Now it's Muslims and every other kind of group. The tagline, the sub-tagline for the group is Welcome the Stranger, Protect the Refugee.
They've got offices in Africa recruiting migrants from Africa.
That's right, exactly. I mean,
they're astonishing.
You have also the International Rescue Committee. I think that was actually started by Albert Einstein himself. They go back to him as one of the sources for this. Same thing with them. Of course, they've been actually pushing a lot of their propaganda. That's really what it is on YouTube recently, making videos about why this why immigration is like inevitable and things like this. You also have another organization I was looking into called IsraAid. Which actually goes to the shores of, Greece, some of the islands there, and basically waves in the boats,
It doesn't take them to Israel, right?
No, of course. And that's the issue, right? Because, I mean, one of the major parts of your critique against this kind of level of organization is not necessarily that, oh, it's not from a standard left point of view where you say they shouldn't be able to organize as a group. What you're focusing on here very heavily is the double standard that to us, they are advocating that it's immoral for us to care about our own and basically organize on the same level that they do. And then, behind the scenes, they are actually doing the very behavior that they dismiss from us, right? That's one of the bigger issues here.
It's one of the big issues. We have like 70-some articles on Axel Observer in that category because it's so common. And it boggles the mind that people with the 130, 140 IQ don't seem to get it when it comes to that. They remain on the left. At the same time, they want Israel as a Jewish state. They want the massive non-white immigration to America. They want multiculturalism. They love the seeing the numbers that whites are slipping into minority status, that they won't be able to win elections anymore. Unless you have 80-90% of white people voting one party, which is not going to happen anytime soon. So, the massive double standard, and again, it goes back to Jewish ethics. It's never been about principles. It's never been about universal principles. Welcome the stranger. They welcome the stranger under certain contexts when it's in their interest to do so. And when it's not, they don't. so it's a very sort of un-Western sense of morality, very unlike, let's say, Kant's and the categorical imperative, where you have universal principles. That's sort of what we mean by morality in the West. But there's simply no understanding of that in these Middle Eastern cultures. And that's true of Judaism, but it's also true of all those cultures. It's really what's good for my group, what's good for me and what's good for my group. That's what morality is. And so when it comes to immigration, they're going to have radically different views in the West, where they think immigration is in their interest, as opposed to Israel, where they're absolutely opposed to it. In fact, one of the big policy things now is to expel all the Palestinians from within Israel. You know, about 20% of Israel is Palestinians, of the old Israel, you know, before the war of 1967, and to expel them onto the West Bank. And so then you would get rid of all the Palestinians within Israel. And again, this is just a good example of how they really do not want diversity when it's on their land. They love diversity when it's in the diaspora, when they believe that's a protective barrier. And what they've done, of course, with all these immigrant groups, including Muslims, is to make alliances with them. They're Jewish-run organizations that reach out to other immigrant groups, whether it's Muslims, Hispanics, Asians, Pacific Islanders, wherever they're from, and make alliances. And you can see that. That's what's happening to voting patterns in this country. These people are voting for the Democrat Party, and white people are increasingly voting for the Republican Party. I worry there's a ceiling for whites to do this because there's so many whites who just don't get it. They are guilty about the white past. They identify with this revolution for whatever reason, even though their own grandchildren are going to curse them for it.
Obviously, what's happening here is we have many different groups that are operating very openly in many cases to kind of make sure that immigrants are brought into the West, Europe, America, the other countries such as Australia, New Zealand, tremendous transformation happening in these countries as well, Canada. And then on one end, then you have them, of course, have a very strict policy when it comes to into their own country, Israel in this case. And this is very simple for many people to find out. It's very much out in the open. Anyone who follows the news a little bit can see these double standards again and again and again. You can go to specific writers even, where they openly, one article, you know, in June 2016, they talk about the immense problems of white people basically organizing, and they call that white supremacy, etc. And then, you know, in August the same year, just a couple of months later, they're just like, why Israel needs to protect its borders and stuff like that. I mean, it's so many cases. Yeah. why do you think it is that people who seem very intelligent on the surface, at least, I don't know what it is. Do they not want to talk about this? We can specifically discuss groups such as the alt-light or something like this, that they refuse to just recognize that this is an issue of concern. And also in the same manner, they try to delegitimize us from raising these very points, that should be off the table. Why do they have this mentality, do you think?
Well, it's an amazing thing, and I've thought about that a lot. In my second book on Jews, Separation of Discontents, I had a chapter at the end on self-deception. And, you know, you could say it's deception, but there are times when they just seem absolutely opaque. And again, this is not a question of not being intelligent. I could explain this hypocrisy to a four-year-old. It's not like it's hard to understand, but it's like goes over their head. And even if you told them on one day, they would come back the next and it wouldn't make any difference. It wouldn't affect anything about what they do. So it's just an amazing thing. Because in that chapter on self-deception, I didn't have any examples on this sort of thing. They were more historical examples, I think. But they were statements that were just so obviously false. Any idiot could see that they were false. And they were being proposed as wisdom. And these other Jews were saluting it, you know, and it just like seemed like this absolute cult mentality where they couldn't think outside a sort of very narrow thing, a very narrow purview. And it's a blind spot. You just cannot talk to them about it. And God knows I've tried. I mean, again, I keep thinking, if I keep posting articles on Oxygen Observer about that, maybe it'll make a difference in the long run. Yeah, I don't see it. It's just not something that is going to be broached in mainstream media at all.
But isn't it true, though, that to a certain extent, when they're pointing it out so much, that a lot of people, I've certainly seen this, Kevin, that a lot of people who begin to ask questions, or they begin to ask the questions rather when they are charged with these accusations.
Yeah.
Right? I've seen that in tremendous amount of people who would never address it before, and then all of a sudden they're put on some list, or they're called a Nazi or white supremacist or whatever, and then they actually begin to look into it. Well, like, what do you say? I've never even talked about, let's say, Jewish interests or something like that. So that
does
happen.
I think it's good for our people.
Yeah.
It's great for our people because it's a easy entree. You know, it's a no-brainer in a way to hit on that issue. I think the Israel lobby is another one, but that issue of the hypocrisy on an immigration and refugee policy is something you can easily talk to people who have not been red-pilled, and they can sort of see why this is an issue. And it doesn't take a lot of insight. So even though Jews have a blind spot on it, that's not the case with our people. And I think they can. That's an entree into understanding the basic issue of the Jewish problem that we have.
Yeah.
The hypocrisy.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the civil rights movement, what happened in 1965 with the Hart-Celler Act, and just why you believe that this was such an important step or milestone for the Jewish organized groups out there?
Well, if you look historically, the Jewish community has always made alliances people they think they can help them in the long run. And early in the 20th century, they started making alliances with blacks. And after World War II, the atmosphere changed quite a bit. Jews assumed much more power in the academic world, the civil rights organizations, and were really gearing up. And I have to say, you know, I'm not a Southerner, and I don't have sympathy with segregation, all those things. I can see more and more now, though, why those things were necessary to protect whites, as we see, you know, because as we see now, as blacks are in the north, they get into school systems, the school systems just are ruined. But whatever the case, and again, I don't want to say that civil rights was a horrible thing. It's just that it was a Jewish movement, and it was intended to advance Jewish and Jewish interests. Not that it was exclusively a Jewish interest, or exclusively a Jewish movement. They managed to get elite opinion across the board in this country, as they have on so many issues related to immigration. But you know, these laws were oftentimes formulated by Jewish organizations. At that time, the NAACP was overwhelmingly Jewish. There were very few, if any, black lawyers in the NAACP at that time, mostly Jewish lawyers. And so it really was a Jewish movement, Jews organizing blacks and getting this going. That lasted at least until the late 1960s. And I think the blacks started to take over more for themselves. But the point is, it really was a Jewish-led movement for a long time. And this has morphed into a lot of things that I think are pathological, affirmative action, you know, and other things that do compromise the interests of the very legitimate interests of white people in fair treatment in the job market, to be evaluated on the basis of your skills and so on. So I do think that in the long run, the civil rights movement, if it just stayed as it was in 1965, I think most Americans would have, I think even a lot of people, conservatives, would have been happy with it. But it's gotten way out of hand. And now we see the Black Lives Matter movement, and we see the hatred, more and more hatred among Black people. Academics, very respectable positions in universities, just exuding hatred towards white people. And so this is a part of the context that I see us heading into an era where whites are not only becoming a minority, they're becoming a hated minority. And the hatred is more and more obvious. If you go on social media, you'll just see these messages from people. Some of them are prominent, some of them are not, but they just exude hate towards white people. It's becoming mainstream, it's becoming normative. And that is the ultimate result of the sort of the civil rights movement, as it has morphed with the far left now being in charge in the universities and the media, really. So it's not benign anymore, whatever it was.
Do you think that this was done because of a moral conviction on the part of those Jewish lawyers and these people that were involved in the civil rights movements at the time? Or did they actually see this as an eventual weapon? This is, of course, very difficult to know. You're not in the head of these people, but through your writing and reading and all these things, is there anything that suggests that they themselves would never implement something like this in, let's say, Israel, right? We've seen a tremendous discrimination against Sudanese and Ethiopians.
The same double standard where civil rights for Palestinians is off the table, where they're doing ethnic cleansing and different legal systems for essentially for Jews and non-Jews in Israel. But there have been Jews who participated in this, who very clearly articulated this as satisfying Jewish interests. And again, the Jewish interest is to lessen the white power structure, to make dents in the white power structure and make alliances with non-white groups. And that's essentially what has happened. So again, at this point, the Black Jewish Alliance is a minor part of it, because there are more Mexican, Hispanic people in America now than there are Blacks. And the Jews have certainly reached out to them. They're very much in favor. Again, talking about the organized Jewish community, the main Jewish communities, very much in favor of easy immigration, not amnesty for illegals, citizenship, all these things which will speed up the demise of white America. So that's just one of their projects, but it's been a big one. And I think that the civil rights movement, more than anything else, has a moral surface that is hard to dispute. But it's something that that is still a consensus, I think, in America. I don't think you'd find that it'd be a minority of white people that say wouldn't want to have segregation, a small minority. But I think when it comes to immigration related issues, I think there'd be there's a solid majority of whites who want to do that. But there's a moral sense, and we have to acknowledge whites did not treat blacks well in this country. I know that. But at the same time, it's not a reason why we have to commit suicide.
Well, no, so many other countries didn't treat their slaves well either. Yeah. It's just a fact. Some treated them, in fact, so bad that they don't even have any survivors of them in their country anymore, because they, they basically neutered them, as it were. Kevin, I want
to... One more point on that.
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the most interesting things in The Bell Curve by Charles Murray was that by around 1960, or a little bit after that, blacks had achieved in America about what you would predict on the basis of their IQ. In other words, substantially, and this is probably because so many blacks had moved north and were into the labor markets and so on, they were able to achieve what you would predict on the basis of their IQ. The problem now, of course, is that the people on the left want equal outcomes without talking about IQ, without talking about impulse control. And so what we see is, again, over and over and over again, are failures in the public school systems. They keep trying to change it. They keep trying to, find some panacea that will change this. It's not changing. The fact is, there are a very large percentage of the black population is beyond hope. They in a sense, can't be part of our civilization. They can't become educated, and they can't control their impulses. They can't hold a job. And so you see city after city, Baltimore, Detroit, Chicago, certain areas, a lot of pretty much any black city, New Orleans, where the, there are large concentrations of these people, because the smarter blacks have left because they can move into the suburbs and do whatever they want. They get good jobs. So you're left with this large percentage of blacks who just can't deal with this, with the modern world. And so there are constant problems, and they're not going to go away. And so I'm a race realist. The civil rights movement, removed legal barriers, but that's all that we should have had to remove. But now we're being asked to get equal outcomes when that is impossible without being completely unfair to whites. Whites always get blamed for black failures. So you ask why don't black children in Baltimore do better? Well, it's because of white racism. They'll find some reason
right.
linked to that. And so they're always blame whites for that. So that's how the civil rights movement has morphed into this monstrosity at the present time. It's all because they don't acknowledge the reality of race and race differences. And that's the fundamental thing. And again, as the bell curve said, if you're just looking at IQ, blacks had already achieved in America about what you would expect on the basis of IQ in terms of social class representation. That's an amazing thing.
Yeah, it's a big problem, not recognizing those differences and being able to work with those. It's tremendously problematic to deny them and trying to work against human nature as opposed to for them. And obviously, as you say, you're talking about generalities here. This is general cut across the medium of the group. There are certainly blacks that are, that can handle this and are well adapted and everything else. We're just talking about the medium, bell curve and how that kind of plays out on the spectrum of IQ it was a problem. Maybe we can even discuss this in the second part here in a little bit, in terms of also the responsibility of slavery and who it actually was that brought many of these slaves to the Caribbean, to South America, and to North America as well, because the Jewish role in the slave trade is never discussed within academia either, which is of course a significant and large one. But Kevin, before we do that and talk a bit more, I actually want to ask you about like Reform Judaism and some of these kinds of groups. Seems to be some interesting dynamic with the more orthodox traditional Jewish movements and stuff like that. We'll get into that later, but want to heads up here for a few people, of course, who are new to Kevin's work, to check out his website, theoccidentalobserver.net. You can find a lot of good articles and stuff there. Check out the archives too. There's just a tremendous amount of material there for you. And then if you haven't already, here of course is the book that we've been talking about. It's a series. It's three books, as I said, but the last one in the series is Culture of Critique. So definitely check that out. It's a magnificent work. The subtitle is An Evolutionary Analysis of Jewish Involvement in 20th Century Intellectual and Political Movements. And then finally, too, Kevin, I do want to plug the Occidental Quarterly. The spring edition is out here for a little while ago, and I imagine the summer is being worked on right now, right?
Right. The summer issue should be sent out. I received my summer issue already. The fall issue is at the printers, so
sometimes excellent.
It takes a little while to get things through the process.
No worry. Tell people how they can, because this is an academic journal, if you will. A lot of good articles. You're of course the editor of this. How can people get a subscription to the magazine?
If you go online, just type in Occidental Quarterly. It'll take you to the TOQ Online website, TOQ Online, and you'll see subscription information. $60 per year for the print version for people that live in the United States. $30 for the electronic version, which is very inexpensive, and it really helps us support a good cause. We're trying to be self-sufficient because it costs money to print. We have to be subsidized at this point, but we're getting there, and we're very close now to achieving a financial stability.
Oh, good. Excellent. So help Kevin and the team there, of course, getting pushed over that edge. Of course, we need a lot of people stepping up to the plate, subscribing to these kinds of journals and getting involved. We cannot do this without, all the support of people out there. That's just the reality of it. And I feel, just a last comment on this, Kevin, before we take a short break. I do feel that things are definitely growing on our end of things. There's a lot of people that are interested in these kinds of questions. They are honestly looking at history. They're honestly looking at things which have been covered up for such a long time. And of course, you coming from an academic background to this, must be kind of rewarding to see that there's a lot of people flooding to it because they're generally interested in trying to understand why was America changed? Why was it demographically transformed in the way it was? Who was responsible? What was the reason, right? These are logical questions to ask in the wake of having your neighborhood turned upside down, right?
In the end, I think we have to ask those questions. I mean, we can have a race realist perspective and leave it at that without asking how we became this way. But it's very unusual for a political movement or an ethnic movement not to have a sort of grasp of history, how we got here to this way. And that's why I think we have to talk about Jewish issues to have a fully formed, intellectually solid movement. We have to be able to discuss how this happened, why it happened, and before we can really go ahead. But it's gratifying. I think a lot of people are getting on board with this, and it's so gratifying to see young people. At the recent American Renaissance Conference, I heard very substantial numbers of young people. Same thing with the National Policy Institute conferences. Very, very encouraging. We're having a larger presence on the street now. It's going to be this event August in Charlottesville.
Yep, Charlotte. That's right.
Very important. Very important to have a public presence and to keep these Antifa people at bay, to fight them if necessary. But we have to have a public presence and be very strong in our courage of our beliefs because this is what we're absolutely right. And I do think that eventually we're going to really make a big impact.
Definitely. Very good, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining us here in the first segment. We're just going to take a short break, ladies and gentlemen. Then we'll continue with more of Kevin MacDonald, talk more about his work, talk about some of the more current events that's been going on. He's always, of course, monitoring the Trump administration and what's going on there. It's been tremendously chaotic, of course. Maybe we can get Kevin's analysis on that, too. But yeah, stay with us. We'll be right back. Check out all the websites. We'll have links in the description and in the show notes to Kevin's work. Support it. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.